Could everybody, everybody, everybody please sit down? And in return, people, welcome onto the stage the band and Bob Dylan.
You can sit down or stand up or lay on the floor as long as you stay with us. I am Suzanne Lang, and I bring you a novel idea. Today's show is not about Bob Dylan or the band per se, but they are among the supporting cast in the story my guest, Jonathan Taplin, tells in his latest book, The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. He was a player, participant, and contributor to some rather amazing cultural milestones from the 60s on up to today. So please stay with us for a novel idea.
Tears of rage, tears of grief. Why am I always the one who must be the thief? Come to me now, you know we're so alone. And life is brief.
The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life is Jonathan Taplin's recently released memoir and is filled with lots of inside stories of the musicians he's worked with, his work with filmmakers such as Martin Scorsese and Wim Wenders, his visits to Cannes and Sundance. One of the chapters of his book is called Strangled by Harvey Weinstein. So there's a lot of good stories here. I, however, was so intrigued with his continual transformation as a professional and growth as a person that led him through being a gawky teenager to a tour manager working with Albert Grossman, Dylan, and the band, to producing movies and on to forge the very concept of streaming media, which is so much part of each of our lives today. Taplin led the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism and the Innovation Lab at USC, and his previous book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Who is this man? Let's listen to my conversation with him, and hopefully it will open some perception for you too, not just on these golden years of rock and roll and cinema, but on this remarkable thinker. Jonathan Taplin, welcome, be it remotely, to Sonoma County to talk about your latest book, The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life.
Good to be here.
Your book is called The Magic Years, and sometimes it seems magical that you have had such opportunities in your life to work with interesting and talented people, and these sequential opportunities that seem to always pull you in slightly different directions, but always building upon what you've already experienced. So there's a lot to explore here, but I guess I want to start off with some themes that I see threaded throughout the book, and maybe even in your previous book, you mention Epicurus, the ancient Greek philosopher. And you were introduced to him at the age of 14 while away at school. And I wonder if you can maybe talk about how Epicurus has been a guiding force for you.
Yeah. You know, I went to a school where they liked the classics, but they didn't just make you read Greek and Latin. They actually immersed you in the philosophers of those periods. And Epicurus, to me, had these three principles that just jumped out at me as a kind of alienated 14-year-old, which was that the notion of a good life requires three things: the company of good friends, the freedom and autonomy to enjoy meaningful work, and an examined life built around some kind of core faith or philosophy. And at the time, I didn't have any of those things. I was very lonely and kind of alienated in a boarding school, sent away for the first time in my life. I had no sense of autonomy, and I didn't really have any sense of faith or philosophy either. And so I saw that as like a great ideal. And hopefully over the course of 50, 60 years, I was able to find those things. But it's a hard journey, you know, it's not easy. And I think, you know, finding the friends was the first step, but finding work that gives you autonomy seems to me to be almost a critical piece. And, you know, I noticed that in the post-pandemic era, there's all this talk about people quitting their jobs. And I think a lot of that is because people don't feel they have any autonomy in their work. They don't have any sense that they're directing, self-directing their lives. And maybe we can create ways of working where you don't always have to be in an office that could give people some sense of autonomy. And then, of course, the third thing, which is having some kind of core faith or philosophy, is maybe the hardest of all. And I've struggled with that for years, but I think I've found it. And partially it's a Christian faith, but partially it's also a kind of holistic faith in the universe.
Yeah, that is a good point, that really that autonomy and what we're going through now culturally, people are searching for something, and some have bought Sprinter vans and have been driving around trying to seek that autonomy, I guess. Another thing that it seems Epicurus is putting forth, that freedom from fear is a real key to happiness. And it seems, I'm saying, that you must have had a degree of fearlessness to just kind of keep taking things on when maybe you didn't really have a foundation for them in all these varying professional spaces that you have worked in.
you're totally right with that. You know, I mean, I made three or four transitions that the rational mind would probably think were insane. Well, I mean, the very first transition was to leave the path that my father had set out for me to become a lawyer and join his firm and everything, go to law school and join a rock and roll band with Bob Dylan and the band. You know, I mean, join in the sense of tour managing them. That was something that neither my mother or my father really thought was a good idea. And then I left the music business in 73 after doing the concert for Bangladesh for George Harrison to just see what was going on in Hollywood, because a lot of the musicians that I really wanted to work for had stopped touring, some because of drugs and some because of just like George Harrison not knowing how to do that without causing chaos. So, you know, I produced my first movie with Marty Scorsese called Mean Streets, and it was a completely naive notion that I could just jump in to be a producer. And I was also naive that I would spend my own money to help make that movie, which was, you know, in Hollywood, they have this phrase OPM, other people's money. And nobody told me about that. And so I made the kind of cardinal error of investing my own money, but it actually turned out wonderfully. The movie was a success and we got all our money back, and I'm still earning profits from it 50 years later. And so I guess the notion is that if you see an opportunity that seems more interesting than what you're doing right now, you should seize it, even if you're not sure you have all the qualifications to handle it. If someone will give you the baton, so to speak, it's probably worth taking a chance. And failure is not the worst thing in the world. If Father Richard Rohr talks about falling upwards, you know. So sometimes failure teaches you great stuff.
Well, you do seem to rather, I'm sure in life it maybe wasn't casual, but maybe it was. You seem to sort of casually articulate in the book how, I thought I'd see what I could do in Hollywood, you know. And so it was kind of amazing that, and you call yourself naive. In the book, you call yourself naive, but it seems like you maybe have a sort of affability that maybe predisposes you to be able to easily communicate with others, or...
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, look, I was lucky that I had a friend named Jay Cox, who was a writer at Time Magazine, who said to me, look, when you go to Hollywood, there's this friend of mine who's an editor, a film editor, named Marty Scorsese, and he edited part of Woodstock. Mm. And he loves music, and he loves the band's music, and you guys would really share a lot of musical tastes. So why don't you look him up? And I did when I got out here, and Marty came up and brought a script he'd been wanting to make for 4 years, ever since he got out of NYU. And I went and looked at his student films, and I liked them a lot. And so I just said, well, let's do this. And I got a friend to give me half the money, and I put up half the money. And for $500,000, we made Mean Streets. So, I mean, there's a certain amount of good fortune involved in that, in the sense that, you know, Marty made a brilliant movie. But it's also a certain sense that if you have a sense of people that you kind of trust, you know, trusting that the band was going to be an important group, or trusting that, you know, maybe streaming media was going to be important in the 1990s. You have to kind of trust those instincts, and that I've always been willing to kind of go along with my own instincts.
And keeping company of good friends, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's definitely an important part of it.
Well, another...
Epicurus.
Yes. And another thing that is, you repeat a couple of times in the book, you say culture leads politics. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit what you mean by that.
Well, my first political introduction sense of engagement came in 1963. And it's a kind of a chicken and egg question, but I mean, obviously I was drawn to the very early work of Bob Dylan, songs like Blowing in the Wind and The Times They Are Changing. And those were political songs, and they were talking about racial reconciliation long before politicians like Lyndon Johnson were willing to push forth civil rights legislation. And so I was partially drawn to the politics of the civil rights movement because I was drawn to Bob Dylan, and I was drawn to Bob Dylan because he shared the politics that I was feeling. And of course, like many of my generation, saw on television a racist sheriff in Birmingham, Alabama, sicking police dogs and fire hoses on a bunch of young teenagers who were just trying to stand up for their rights. And so that outraged me, that these young Black kids had literally had to jump the walls of their school to go into Birmingham to protest, and were met with such viciousness, with billy clubs and fire hoses and police dogs. And it really shocked me in such a deep way that I literally the next day went and signed up for the Students for Nonviolent Coordinating Committee called SNCC, which was run by John Lewis and Bob Moses. So the politics and the culture were completely united in that time. Now, it hasn't always been that way. And I would maybe argue that, you know, there's more separation of it now than there was in the 60s. And maybe that's part of the problem.
Yeah. And in some ways, in your previous book, Move Fast and Break Things, I think you take that on as maybe what is causing some of that separation is a dilution of stuff out there that tends to peg things.
Well, social media is both a blessing and a curse. You know, I've said before that if Facebook had been around in 1955, we'd still be dealing with polio. It's, you know, the resistance and the very fact that there's still 30% of the people in the United States who haven't gotten vaccinated is because of Facebook.
Yeah.
There's no other cause. It's just been proven. And so that is the fount of disinformation in our society. That's where it all comes from. And of course, that also is the fount of where artists get disempowered, in the sense that if YouTube can put anybody's music up for free without their permission, how is an artist going to make a living in the modern age? And that is a real conundrum. I mean, it's not like I have any belief that we're going to get rid of Facebook and YouTube. You know, I'm sure they serve some good purposes. They're certainly advertising millions of dollars every week on sports programming to tell you that they're a critical part of American society. I mean, you wonder, why is Google and Facebook spending millions of dollars on TV advertisements? They have monopolies. Right. They don't need to advertise. What are you going to, you think you need an advertisement to tell you to go to Google right. to search for stuff?
Right.
It's nonsense. Yeah. They're doing it because they're afraid that people don't think well of them. And so they have to enhance their kind of feel-good identity. It's absurd.
Well, and it's a conundrum for all of us, whether we're artists or consumers, that we go to Google, we use Facebook, and we use YouTube, Amazon. You know, within a few minutes of booking this conversation together, you know, within 90 seconds, I had downloaded your other book, and I might have gotten irritated if it had taken right. me longer. So, we you know, we've become these large institutions like Facebook and Google have really given us a sense of entitlement that now we're, well, I'll use that word, addicted to.
I agree.
Yeah.
But think about them. They're like, they've become utilities mm-hmm. in the sense like, I mean, nobody's going to criticize you for using electricity, right? But if there's only one electric company, you know, we probably ought to regulate that company so it doesn't extract outrageous rents for its service. And that's exactly what Facebook and YouTube and Google are doing. They're extracting rents that are way beyond the utility of what they do. In other words, there's a reason why the largest market capitalization corporations in the world are Facebook, Google, and Amazon.
Yeah.
It's because they're able to extract rents for a service to which you have no other alternative. I mean, who's going to start a competitor to Google? That would just like be a fool's errand. You want to lose $3 billion? Go at it, you know? So, I mean, that's the question. It's not whether these things are good or bad. I have no valence on that. I think they have deleterious effects on our democracy and on our artistic output, but they're not going to go away. I understand that. So then the question becomes, well, how do we regulate them? How do we tell Amazon that it can't advantage its products that it has ownership in over the products of people who are making competitive products to what they do. You know, the famous story about there was a company called diapers.com that was making some kind of very crunchy granola diapers that people liked, you know, that were very organic or something. And that Amazon could see from its own data that people were really liking these diapers. So Amazon just went and made a knockoff of those diapers. And obviously, when you would search for those kind of diapers, Amazon would put its product up ahead of the diapers.com thing. And eventually diapers.com gave up and sold out to Amazon. You know, I mean, and that story had been played out time and time and time again.
Well, I'm going to steer our listeners to your previous book, Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, to hear you talking much more about this in depth. And before either one of us get on a rant about it, let's talk about coming back to your life in that you're expressing in the book. Though I will say that you do say, I believe in the power of rock and roll books and movies to upset the world. So I think that's something that we can count on from you, and maybe we all ought to embrace a little bit of that. But you, as you tell us in the book, your story largely begins at the Newport Folk Festival, where, as you said, you had been turned on to the music of Dylan, and from a friend of your brother's, you got a backstage pass to the Newport Folk Festival. And this happened to be where Dylan plugs in, much to the dismay of Alan Lomax and the crowd waiting for him to play Blowin' in the Wind. And you were there and seemed to know that this was a significant event almost right away. Were you just like gobsmacked by it, or did you see this as a transition?
Well, the first reaction was, what the hell? The fans are booing Bob Dylan. I'd never heard that before. You know, I mean, why? I mean, I understand that maybe it wasn't very well rehearsed and all sorts of other things, but why this incredibly negative reaction from the folkies to Dylan's electric debut at Newport? So that was the first reaction. Then the second reaction was, well, if people are reacting this seriously, this must be very important, both in the sense of why do they feel this need to reject this? And in that sense, it felt like things that I had only read about, you know, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring in Paris, when the people booed and walked out, you know, those kind of moments that people signify as a break point in time, you know. And obviously Stravinsky was making this very modern music, and it was being rejected by people who just wanted to hear Beethoven, right? I mean, so I understand that there are these things come, these cracks in the known universe actually do arrive. And so it began to dawn on me that what Dylan was doing was much more important than just that one moment. And then, of course, because I had begun working for his manager, Albert Grossman, while I was at Princeton as a weekend road manager, I began to sense that this was not just a one-time thing. It continued. And he eventually hired the Hawks, Levon and the Hawks, which were now we know as the band, to be his backup band. And they experienced for 16 months the same reaction. Bob would go out and do the first half of a show acoustic. And then he'd come on with the band in the second half and they'd get booed. And it was just like, not just on the East Coast, but all across America. And then the same thing in Europe. You can hear some of the tapes from England, people yelling, "Judas, you know, you're a betrayer." And so it really was this weird sense that people couldn't take that, and they thought it was some kind of sellout. And on the other hand, from my point of view, just listening to the music, it was great music. I mean, what Dylan and the band were doing in 1965 and 1966 was incredibly powerful and important. And I just loved every minute of it.
And in fact, you say that the music they were playing at the time prefigured punk rock.
Yeah, it was.
In that it was that much of a departure.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, Bob once said to Robbie Robertson, you know, don't stop playing no matter what happens. And Robbie told me once that literally these kids were coming up on stage to try and unplug their amplifiers. And he was like using his Fender guitar as a weapon to battle them off. It was that chaotic.
Was that experience what turned Dylan off from touring for a few years?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Bob did, despite all of these conspiracy theories, Bob did have a very bad motorcycle accident.
Oh, right.
In 1966, and broke his back. And I think it was the universe telling him to slow down. I mean, I'm not the only person to have written about this, but obviously the use of amphetamine as a way to get yourself up to write or to perform became something that was pretty used regularly by Dylan in those years. I mean, he told the New York Times writer Robert Shelton that he had been up for 3 days when he went off his motorcycle. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you don't stay up for 3 days unless you're taking a fairly large amount of speed. So I think the accident was a way for, you know, the universe to say, hey, man, cool it or you're going to be dead. And it doesn't escape me that, you know, in 69 and 70 and 71, a lot of very famous rock stars died.
Yes.
From different kind of addictions. But still, I mean, the effect of thinking that you're invincible when you're young leads to really stupid behavior.
And you seemed to be able to stay outside of that largely, even though you were exposed to it. And drugs and coke and that sort of thing. So, but you could see it at the time, what it was doing to people.
Well, you know, if you're the tour manager, you have to be the responsible citizen. So you have to go to bed at a fairly decent hour so that you can get up early and organize everybody to get on the next airplane. So you're not allowed to stay up till 5 a.m. snorting cocaine. You know, that's not in the job description. And I also had very bad allergies. So I was like the Woody Allen character in snorting cocaine. I'd sneeze and the whole thing would go on the floor. So, I mean, I never got into, I mean, I smoked my share of pot in the time, but I was never into that. And, you know, I watched it kind of pull the band apart and to the point that I eventually left because I didn't see that as a good future.
Yeah, there's a anecdote in the book you talk about when the Rolling Stones wanted you to manage one of their tours, and your experience of kind of having an initial meeting with them. And you, at one point, one of them come in, and you could just tell by looking at and his twitchiness that you didn't want to have to be that kind of babysitter, and you declined the job because of it.
Yeah, I had just gone through a very rough experience doing the concert for Bangladesh with Eric Clapton, who was addicted to heroin. And the trouble of just trying to get him on stage for one night, two performances, was so much that when I arrived in the south of France to interview with the Stones for their Exile on Main Street tour, you know, I had a 1 o'clock meeting, and I think the meeting started around 4, and around 7 p.m., Keith Richards finally got himself out of bed. And, you know, it just the scratching his neck and just the look in his eyes, it was just full out junkie alert for me. And I thought, one day with Eric was bad enough, but imagine doing this 5 days a week for 3 months. I would die. And so I just, before I was even offered the job, I declined the opportunity. And, you know, I don't regret it at all. And by the way, both Eric Clapton and Keith Richards got their together and actually managed to get clean. And, you know, they'll probably live till into their 90s, you know.
Yes. Though that didn't end your association with the Stones. And it seems like you got involved with making a suggestion about an album cover. And I don't know that I am overstating this to say that it really led to a resurgence of interest in the photographer Robert Frank. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and about Robert Frank and his influence on you.
About 4 months after I had been in the south of France, I got a call from Mick Jagger's secretary, who asked me to come over to his rented house in Bel Air with an idea for an album cover, because he had liked the album covers I'd done for the band. And so as I was going out the door, I picked up a book by Robert Frank, who was a Swiss photographer, called The Americans. And it was made in 1955 on a cross-country trip. And it's filled with these extraordinarily evocative pictures of the heart of America. There's a cowboy next to a glowing jukebox, or there's a black preacher on the side of the Mississippi River. And it's just astonishing book. And so I brought it with me. And after dinner, I said to Keith, look, everyone knows what the Rolling Stones look like. You don't need to put your picture on the cover. Why don't you just put one of these pictures on the cover? It's perfect for the title Exile on Main Street. And Mick picked up the book and started flipping through the pages. And he was just like, wow, this is incredible. This is incredible. And then he lifted up his head and said to me, well, let's get this guy to take our picture. And I said, that's not what I was suggesting. I said, put one of these pictures on the cover. And he said, no, I want him to take our picture. I said, this book was made in 1955. I don't even know if this guy is still living. And he said, well, if he's living, you can find him. If you put the word out that the Rolling Stones will pay him $20,000 to take their picture, he'll show up, I promise you. So I went back home and started calling around and discovered that he was living in his daughter's house in Maybu, Nova Scotia, which is really the end of the earth. And it was February, and I called up to and realized that Maybu, Nova Scotia had what's called a party line. So there was like a central operator in the town, and she would plug you into the various houses. And I asked to speak to the Frank house, and she said, well, the wires are all down because there was a bad storm last week. And I said, well, when will the wires be back up? And she said, oh, in a couple of months when all the storms thing. I said, well, how can I reach them? And she said, well, his daughter comes into the general store once a week for supplies, so you could leave a message for her there. So I called, she put me over to the general store, and it just so happened that his daughter was there. And I talked to her and managed to convince her that this wasn't some prank, that the Rolling Stones really did want to pay him $20,000. And that was clearly the most money he'd heard of in the last 10 years. And in a week, he was in Los Angeles in a bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel, living the life of Riley and regaling Mick with great stories of Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and all the beats that he'd hung out with. And eventually, I would just watch him, and he had a little Super 8 movie camera that he would just shoot little 10, 15 second bursts of film all the time. And one day I saw him going through the trash bin in Mick's office and pulling stuff and putting it in his pocket. And eventually the manager got really pissed off and said, this old guy has got to take a picture or I'm sending him home. So we organized a photo shoot downtown at the Grand Central Market. Needless to say, Keith Richards shows up really late. The light is fading. Robert gets about three pictures done. And the manager completely loses it and says, he's going home. This is amateur hour. And Mick says, okay, you can send him home, but give him the $20,000. And the manager just, what are you talking about? And he said, no, just give him the $20,000. So I took him to the airport and I said, I'm sorry, it didn't work out. I gave him the check for $20,000. And I thought, well, that was kind of an amazing gesture on Mick's part to take care of this old artist. And 2 weeks later, the complete album cover for Exile on Main Street shows up like a Rauschenberg collage with these little strips of film and old Robert Frank pictures and little pieces of paper, which were lyrics that Mick had written. And the whole thing was so amazing. It won the Grammy for best album cover. And of course, then Mick invited, feeling triumphant, invited Robert on tour with him. And Robert made the notorious film called Cocksucker Blues, which then the Stones proceeded to bury. So that was that story.
A little too raw. The movie was a little too raw for them.
Way too raw.
But it seemed like people were able to take another look at Robert Frank.
Completely. It revived his career. He had exhibits in New York and Toronto and Paris. I mean, everything changed for Robert after that.
Yeah.
The book was reissued. It was everything.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful story. I am talking with Jonathan Taplin on his book, The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. We'll visit more with him in just a minute. Let's take a short break.
My friend came to me, sadness in his eye, told me that he wanted help for his country. All of you to help us save some lives.
I'm not afraid to
was George Harrison performing at the Concert for Bangladesh in 1971, a significant event presenting the social power of artists bringing their voice to an urgent humanitarian cause. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you a novel idea. My guest is Jonathan Taplin, and we're talking about his book, The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. John was friends with George Harrison, who asked him to help organize what would become the Concert for Bangladesh. Let's pick up our conversation there. So you have mentioned a couple times the Concert for Bangladesh, and this seems like it might have been one of the first big concerts of its sort where musicians come together from all over the place. And it was really a demonstration of the power of art and music to bring people together and to support an issue of justice in the world. And so I'm wondering what you learned from producing it, and was this a kind of a segue then into your film career?
Well, you know, the book is called The Magic Years for a reason, in the sense that there was a time when the artist was willing to kind of put themselves out there and take a chance to do something socially redeeming. And George Harrison had, you know, the Beatles had split up and George was making his own solo album. And his friend Ravi Shankar had said to him, look, there's this new state called Bangladesh. It had been called East Pakistan. And it's like the plague of locusts has descended on this country. There's famine, there's typhoons, there's flooding, it's just everything is going wrong and nobody is paying any attention to it. And because it's a brand new country, it's not even in the United Nations, so there's no help from anybody. And so George said, well, let's do a concert. And we called down to George's manager, Alan Klein, and he was able to book Madison Square Garden for August 1st, literally 50 years ago, this August. And George very quickly organized a band with Ringo Starr and Jim Keltner and Klaus Voormann and Leon Russell and Billy Preston and then Eric Clapton as guitar. And it came together quickly. And then he got Bob Dylan to agree to appear as well. And, you know, quite frankly, I think it did serve exactly the purpose that George had imagined. By the time the concert was over, the name Bangladesh was on everyone's lips. People understood what it was. And the concert over the years has raised almost $30 million for UNICEF. And although, you know, that's only a small part of UNICEF's budget, Bangladesh has actually turned into being a development success story. I mean, it's really quite successful. You probably look inside your t-shirts and see they're manufactured in Bangladesh instead of India or Vietnam, you know. And so, you know, I think it did everything it was needed to do. It wasn't flawless. I mean, it was a tough thing to pull off, in the sense for George had to carry most of the weight. And there were some very nervous moments around both, you know, in terms of Eric Clapton's ability to actually perform and Bob Dylan's willingness to perform. But it all, in the end, it all worked out kind of beautifully.
Jonathan Taplin, we are sadly running out of time, and there's so much more I want to talk to you about.
Well, it's been fun.
Your foray into a movie streaming service or a media streaming service, Entertainer, I guess our readers are just going to have to dive into the book and find out a lot more about these magic years. But one thing I guess I would like you to leave us with perhaps is, you know, in the 60s and 70s, there were assassinations, the draft, and racial unrest in our cities. And then this incredible transformation of art and music and film. Right now, we are experiencing so much social and cultural dis-ease, and maybe are really bent right now for a revolutionary retooling. And I guess I just wonder, what are your thoughts and maybe even, dare I say, advice to us as consumers and users, or for yourself and your own continued trajectory?
Well, I think the artists have to play a role here in doing this. It doesn't escape my notice that over the last summer, both in the Black Lives Matter movement and in the fall over the movement to get people to register to vote, that LeBron James had a much higher profile than Jay-Z or any hip-hop artists. So the musicians were taking a back seat to the basketball stars. And maybe that's just culturally, LeBron James had more clout or more courage. But for whatever reason, that happened. What disturbs me the most is that I find that the most popular of the current cultural movements, which is not music right now, it's kind of TV drama, is rather dystopian. If you look at the post 9/11 TV dramas, you've Sopranos, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, Succession, all of them are unified by one thing, which is that the protagonist is a terrible person who is what we would call an anti-hero, who does awful things in order to struggle for power in a totally corrupt world. If that's the message that you're constantly delivering to the world, then it's no surprise to me that in 2016, a bunch of people said, well, if that's the way the world works, let's hire one of those creeps to be president, you know, because he'll understand how horrible the world is and he'll drain the swamp. You know, now that was a complete cocked up illusion. But the point is that I think the culture has a responsibility not to make people think that the world is completely corrupt, because I think that sense of catastrophizing that everything is going down the tubes leads us to all sorts of bad outcomes. I mean, even yesterday, you know, you got people saying, whoa, maybe the pandemic is not over and we're going to have a whole other third wave of this. And I understand it sells newspapers and it gets people to watch TV because they're afraid. But this constant fear mongering is not useful for society. And the music I grew up with was incredibly aspirational. The times, they are a changing.
Yes.
We shall overcome.
Yes.
It's the answer is blowing in the wind. It's coming. That sense of hope, like change can come, needs to come from the artistic community. And quite honestly, I don't see it coming from the music community. I don't even see it coming from the film and television community. And so if that doesn't happen, then you get that kind of sense of resignation, like the end of Chinatown. Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown. There's nothing you can do about it. You know, and that's not helpful.
Well, Jonathan Taplin, you just gave me goosebumps. So that's and we could even go back to Epicurus, freedom from fear, being
right.
a key.
Totally. Totally.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. Really appreciate it. The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. All the best to you.
Thank you, Suzanne.
I wasn't kidding. There's lots more to John's story, which is filled with wit, humility, and candor. The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life by Jonathan Taplin. I enjoy reads like his because I am then encouraged to listen to some of the music and to watch the films he talks about with new eyes and new ears. In fact, we'll play out today with Lou Reed and What's Good, featured on the soundtrack of Wim Wenders' Until the End of the World, a film produced by Taplin. John's previous book that you may want to look at is Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And among the many things he talks about in that book is how these monopolistic enterprises have served to deprive artists of revenue. Thank you, Jonathan Taplin. We opened the show with a snippet from Bob Dylan and the band being introduced at the music festival on the Isle of Wight in 1969. This was Dylan's first public appearance after a 3-year hiatus. In the book, Taplin says that when John Lennon and George Harrison came up to Dylan, they were almost intimidated by him. We also listened to a bit of Tears of Rage from Dylan and the band from the bootleg series, part of the infamous Basement Tapes, recorded in the basement of Big Pink, the house members of the band had outside of Woodstock, New York, where Dylan lived. Next time, we feature a guest also having a nexus with Mick Jagger. Arnold Levine's story is Banned by the BBC, How I Became a Radio Pirate, a memoir of 1970s London. It's a funny, irreverent story of pirate radio, the squat culture, punk music, and social issues in 1970s London, banned by the BBC with Arnold M.D. Levine. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for joining me. We have production assistance from James Morey and Mark Prell. I am here the first and fifth Sunday of each month. You can listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast and listen anytime at krcb.org. Follow the FM program links. We are a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Northern California Public Media, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's a novel idea.
Life's like Minnesota, and life's like space without room, and life's like bacon and ice cream. That's what life's like without you. Life's like forever becoming, but life's forever dealing in hurt. Now life's like death without living. That's what life's like without you. Life's like Sanskrit read to a pony. I see you in my mind's eye, strangling on your tongue. What good is knowing such devotion? I've been around, I know what makes things run. What good is seeing our chocolate? What good's a computerized nose? And what good was cancer in April? Why no good? No good at all. Thinking it must be better, huh, not to be thinking at all. A styrofoam good lover with emotions of concrete. No, not much. Not much at all. What good is life without living? What good's this lion that barks? You loved a life of this throwaway nightly. It's not fair. Not fair at all. What's good? Oh, baby, what's good? What's good? What's good? Not much at all. Hey, baby, what's good?